Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and it is day two of the Democrats' opening arguments in the Senate impeachment trial of President Trump, who is accused of abusing his power by pressuring Ukraine to investigate Joe Biden and obstructing Congress as they investigated. Congressman Jim Jordan is a Republican from Ohio who is one of eight House members working on President Trump's defense team and joins us now. Congressman, welcome.
Good to be with you, Jeremy.
So the Democratic House managers have been making their case. Is the Trump defense team going to respond point by point to the evidence that the Democrats have presented?
The Trump defense team will present the facts, and the facts are all on the president's side. They'll also talk about the unconstitutional nature of the two articles, and I also believe they will discuss the process abuse, the lack of due process is a better way to say it, that took place in the House of Representatives. The president was denied just any measure, any semblance of due process. He wasn't allowed to have lawyers present during the witness deposition. He wasn't allowed to cross-examine. I mean, it was and Republicans couldn't subpoena any of the witnesses we wanted. So that'll be part of the case as well. But primarily, it's going to be, I think, pointing out the fact that the key facts are all on the president's side.
Well, wasn't the president offered the chance to have lawyers and he decided not to? That the White House decided that they didn't want to have their lawyers in those hearings in the House committee?
Yeah, the last week of a process that started on September 24th when Nancy Pelosi announced that they were going to do an impeachment investigation, and the last week when it finally went to the Judiciary Committee in December, they said, "Oh, by the way, we'll let you come now." No, never mind the 17 depositions done in the bunker in the basement of the Capitol. We're not going to let the White House have any lawyers there. We're not going to let the Republicans subpoena any of the witnesses they want to ask questions. And in fact, the witnesses that the Democrats subpoenaed, there were times when Adam Schiff prevented questions we had as Republicans, prevented the witness from answering our questions. Democrats got all their questions answered in those depositions, but Republicans didn't, because Adam Schiff served as not only chairman, he served as counsel for the witnesses that he subpoenaed.
Congressman,
there's no way the president had any kind of due process in the House proceedings.
So to where we are now, do you agree that the president did nothing wrong? This is what he said, that it is not wrong to ask a foreign leader to investigate a political rival and to hold up military aid to that country at the same time.
Well, look, aid was not ultimately held. It was paused for a few days when the president was checking out to make sure that this new guy, this former TV personality who just got elected and whose party had just taken over their parliament, to see if he was legit, if he was a genuine reformer as he campaigned to be. And over that time, the president became convinced, because senior U.S. officials met with President Zelensky. We had U.S. senators, we had the vice president, we had the head of the NSC all meet with President Zelensky in that 55-day period when the aid was on hold. And they all said, "You know what? We think we can. We think this guy's going to. He's the real deal."
But
even
if that's the case, and that is definitely in dispute, that's the reason why the aid was withheld. Is it okay for him to ask for a favor, as he did on that call, for the president of Ukraine to investigate a political rival?
Jeremy, you're missing the four key facts. The four key facts are: we have the call transcript. Tell me where the quid pro quo was. Wasn't there. The two individuals who were on the call, who talked to each other, have repeatedly said, in fact, the very next day, President Zelensky, in a previously scheduled meeting, the very next day, so the call's on the 25th, the next day, July 26th, President Zelensky meets with Ambassadors Volker, Sondland, and Taylor in Kyiv, and guess what he said? The call was great. The call was fine. Had a good call with the President of the United States. No pressure, no linkage, no pushing. He later repeatedly says that there was none of that. Third, Ukrainians didn't even know aid was on hold at the time of the call. So how could there be pressure? How could there be a favor? How could we say, if you want the aid, you got to do X? They didn't even know aid was on hold at the time. And most importantly, tell me when they started the investigation. Tell me when they promised to start the investigation. Tell me when they announced they were thinking about starting. It never happened. So this idea that somehow there was a quid pro quo, to have a quid pro quo, something has to happen. They never made the announcement. They never started an investigation. And they've never promised to start an investigation. And guess what? They got the meeting with the president. They got the money. And They got the phone call.
So the Democrats don't want to look at the facts. Yeah, we're getting a preview, I guess, of what we're going to hear when the Trump defense team has its moment in the Senate trial. Do you think that there should be witnesses at this point, based on what you've heard? Should there be witnesses allowed in this trial?
I think the case should have been or the trial should have been done already. I mean, I think that a motion to dismiss, a motion to acquit up front, would have been the appropriate measure. The Senate said, no, we're going to hear from both sides, let them present their arguments, and then take the questions. At that point, there'll be a decision made whether there'll be witnesses or not. That'll be up to the United States Senate. I think once they see all the facts, as we've just talked about in a brief way here, but once they see all the facts laid out, I think that they'll I hope that there won't be witnesses called. But if you do, if you go down that road, if you start down the witness road, then you got to go all the way down it. You can't just say, the prosecution can call their witnesses, but the president can't call witnesses he might want. So if we're going to start down that road, I think you got to go all the way down it.
That is Congressman Jim Jordan, Republican from Ohio, who is one of the House members working on President Trump's defense team in the impeachment trial. Congressman, thanks for joining us.
You bet. Thank you, Jeremy. Take care.
Well, when Republicans do present the president's case in the Senate trial, Alan Dershowitz, professor emeritus at Harvard Law, will be arguing on his behalf. You probably know he said he'll argue that abuse of power and obstruction of Congress are not impeachable offenses because there's no crime, no law broken. But as we've pointed out, Alexander Hamilton said in the Federalist Papers, all you need is violation of the public trust. Let's go deeper with Stephen Vladeck, law professor at the University of Texas, Austin. Professor, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And we want to touch in on these legal questions as we go along in this trial. You know Dershowitz's view, contrary, by the way, to statements he made in 1998 when he said there certainly doesn't have to be a crime for impeachment. He's now said he has a more sophisticated argument, and he's basing it on the defense of President Andrew Johnson. In his impeachment trial in the 1800s, Johnson impeached for removing a Secretary of War. There's also concern he wasn't going to carry out Reconstruction after the Civil War, but the argument from his lawyer was, but there's no law broken, and he was cleared. So why doesn't it follow, as Dershowitz says, that, see, that was used as a defense?
So first, I mean, I think we should clarify the record. I mean, Johnson was cleared in the sense that one senator voted the other way. Had it gone one senator differently, Johnson would have been removed. But, you know, if we look at the broader history of impeachment, and it's not just Alexander Hamilton, it's, you know, impeachment of other federal officials besides presidents. It's the proposed articles of impeachment against President Nixon. It just has been understood always that there are examples of gross misconduct, what the founders called maladministration, that would be impeachable whether or not there were a technical violation of the criminal code. Otherwise, we're setting up a scenario where basically the ability to remove a president for not acting in America's best interests depends upon what Congress has chosen to criminalize. It's not how the founders understood impeachment. It's not how the Andrew Johnson and Richard Nixon impeachment discussions went. And I think it would set a bad precedent for presidents going forward.
Well, and we should add, when we look back at the Johnson case, as you say, it was just one vote, but also Republican senators were worried about who would have succeeded him. He was a radical Republican. He was disliked by more conservative Republicans, so that factored into that vote. And as you were alluding to, there wasn't a federal criminal code when the founders drew up the Constitution.
That's right. And so I think, you know, the key here is that we should all agree that presidents should not be subject to impeachment solely for political differences. One of the first impeachments in American history, the impeachment of Supreme Court Justice Samuel Chase, failed largely because the Senate said these are just political differences. These are not allegations of the type of misconduct that should result in removal from office. But we should all be comfortable with the idea that if a president, for example, refused to order the army to defend the country from an imminent attack or took other steps to basically put his interests ahead of the country, it really doesn't matter whether those are criminal, especially in a world in which, you know, the government takes the position that a sitting president can't be indicted. The real question is, does a majority of the House and two-thirds of the Senate honestly believe that the president is acting in violation of his oath, that the president is acting in derogation of the country's best interests? And if the answer is yes, I think getting caught up on the formality of what Congress has chosen to proscribe misses the forest for a pretty specific and distracting tree.
And one more historical note, because I love this one. We're reading in the Associated Press, which dug into this history, that behind the scenes, he also promised senators that he'd stop impeding Reconstruction. election. And some historians believe that the senator who cast the deciding vote was bribed.
Vice President Pence wrote an op-ed last week about how Senator Ross, the senator whose vote was the swing vote in the Senate, how he was a profile in courage. Well, this is the exact example that we should be trying to break, because Ross was not only bribed for his vote, but he was offered tons of federal patronage in exchange for voting not to remove President Johnson. It is the exact example we should be trying to break from in this moment in American history.
Real quick, the president said yesterday he'd like to see Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and others, including former National Security Advisor John Bolton, testify, but there's a national security risk. What's the scholarly view of that?
Well, I mean, first, it's worth stressing, you know, the notion that there's a national security risk in things that have been said publicly, stated publicly, I think is a little bit tough to swallow. But ultimately, you know, the trial rules come down to the Senate. Even if the Senate agrees to call someone like John Bolton, you know, Bolton could assert executive privilege. We should all understand, though, that executive privilege is not a right to not testify. Executive privilege doesn't cover things like what conversations did he have with people other than the president. So the notion that, you know, this privilege could block this testimony, I think, is a convenient cover for those who don't want these folks to testify at all.
Stephen Vladeck, law professor at the University of Texas, Austin. Professor, thank you.
Thank you.
Who was Qasem Soleimani, and what exactly was his role in Iran? This week on Throughline, how the assassinated Iranian general and the organization he represented have shaped the relationship between the U.S. and Iran for decades. That's this week on Throughline from NPR, the podcast where we go back in time to understand the present.
In a few short weeks, Americans will cast the first votes of the 2020 election season. The Iowa caucuses are on February 3rd, followed by the New Hampshire primary on the 11th. A few days later, the Nevada caucuses. And every 4 years, we have to remind ourselves, how does that work again? How are the primaries and caucuses different? What's Super Tuesday? So for a primer, let's bring in Josh Putnam, a political scientist and founder of the election tracking website Frontloading HQ. He also writes about the primary process for political sites like 538 and the Rasmussen Reports. He joins us from North Carolina. Welcome.
Hey, Robin.
And so let's start with the caucuses, or caucusi, as I've heard them referred to. These are just so wonderfully American and wild. In a caucus, you go to one particular place and everybody kind of runs around the room to stand with somebody representing the candidate you vote for, right?
Right, right. So unlike a primary where you're going in, your time there is only as long as it is to sign in and wait in line to vote. At a caucus, you're there for a meeting on a weekday evening. As you said, right, folks go in there not to cast a secret ballot, but instead they kind of congregate and persuade each other in some cases to come and join a particular candidate's group.
So it's a very public vote. And in some cases, the parties don't like them because of that, because it takes a long time and it's so public. And we have fewer caucuses this year.
That's right. That's right. The Democratic Party in particular has had some issues with consistency within their own philosophy of how these things go, right? They've talked for years now about being more inclusive in terms of bringing people into the process. And caucuses, to some extent, run against that in terms of participation. They tend to be lower in turnout and so on and so forth. So the party adopted some rules this past go-around to encourage states, basically, to shift to a primary format, a state-run primary format, rather than parties running caucuses to increase participation.
And there are some other requirements. We'll get to that. But just to underscore what you just said, the three largest caucus states, that's Washington, Minnesota, and Colorado, have flipped to primaries. So have Utah, Idaho, and Nebraska. Another complaint seemed to be that the caucuses can, I mean, this is the claim of the critics, that the caucuses can benefit the activist candidates with a more energetic, sometimes younger base. So a Bernie Sanders, for instance, might do better in a place where he has so many energetic followers who can gin up that event, but it may not be really descriptive of how the vote is going.
If Iowa, for instance, was to switch to a primary, then we may see a slightly different result, right? You may see increased participation in that format. It may not bring you a different result, but it may change up some of the rank orderings within the candidates and so on and so forth.
And so further explain some of the requirements. A candidate has to get 15% at a primary or a caucus in order to get delegates, but that becomes even more obvious
at a caucus, because you can see by the number of people standing with the representative of the candidate whether or not you have 15%.
Absolutely. And we saw this particularly in 2008. The caucuses that were aired on the Democratic side kind of bore that out, right? Mm-hmm. That folks could see that the action was over in the Obama corner in a lot of those precincts across the state. And you saw some movement toward his areas of the room across the state.
And we understand that the number of delegates awarded by caucuses is down anyway to 3%. Is that correct?
Right. So the number of states that you mentioned before that shifted from primaries to caucuses is greatly reduced. So mm-hmm. now we're down to basically Iowa, Nevada, and Wyoming as the lone remaining caucus yeah. states.
I'm a little sad about that because caucuses are so much fun and so entertaining. But to the idea that both Iowa and then New Hampshire, which is a primary, are, you know, have this first in the nation fervor. You know, some people have objected to that because these are two very white states.
They are. Both are overwhelmingly white, over 90% white in both cases. Again, that's something that is kind of counter to the philosophy of the Democratic Party, being more inclusive on a whole host of demographic dimensions, race being one of them. I mean, again, this isn't a new question that the party's been dealing with.
Right.
The whole impetus for adding states to the early lineup back for the 2008 cycle was what drove South Carolina and Nevada being added early on, to bring in South Carolina's case, some African-American voters, in Nevada's case, to bring in Latino but also union support in an early state in an effort to mitigate some of that. Nonetheless, these same sorts of diversity issues have persisted.
Well, and the goal, the hope is to get the voters, as the process goes along, to more represent the electorate, right? So that you really have a clear sense of what the electorate wants.
That's right. I think sometimes when we kind of jump in with Iowa, though, or New Hampshire, any of the early states, we tend to forget the stuff that's going on now, that's been going on since the last presidential election, the so-called invisible primary, where you do see some legitimate jockeying among the prospective candidates, and then as they emerge, the candidates themselves who are running. And those are efforts that appeal to a wide variety of constituencies within the party. No, it's not directly affecting votes, not until you get into Iowa and New Hampshire. But those voices are being brought into that process. I mean, I think we've seen that play out to some degree, at least indirectly, through the debates process this time.
Yeah. Well, but talk about Super Tuesday. This is the day in March when so many states have their primaries. California's now been added to that. And many people have said that finally makes Super Tuesday more representative of the electorate, because prior to that, the states that were involved, Georgia, other, you know, southern states, tilted Super Tuesday towards an African-American vote in a way that didn't represent the percentage of African-American voters.
It was an overrepresentation, one could say. But we should also note that historically speaking, the idea of a kind of a Southern Super Tuesday has been one that has ebbed and flowed over time. So certainly kind of the beginning part of starting Super Tuesday was a Southern phenomenon back in 1988. We saw that kind of repeat itself 4 years ago in 2016 when a number of Republican secretaries of state across the South tried to coordinate a Southern flavored Super Tuesday last time around. But we've certainly seen Super Tuesdays where California's been involved, New York's been involved in past cycles and so on and so forth.
Well, but that also, do I understand, and this might have been your writing, that California being involved, while it may, you know, put the African-American vote at the percentage that it more represents across the country, the votes come in so late from California that someone can stand up on the night of Super Tuesday and say, I won, but they really didn't. And the next day, you know, when the California votes are tallied, the truth will be that they did not win.
Even now, it's not going to be the next day because of the way that California counts votes. They've got vote by mail for a large portion of their electorate there. So as we saw in 2016, we didn't get a final tally on California until, gosh, it was nearly a month after that June primary. What's talked about this time around is that California voters are going to be able to vote early this go-around, and that may have some impact. But we're also going to have to wait on the back end for what those results are going to be.
Yeah. What else do you want us to know? What should we be thinking about the primaries, again, where you go into a booth and you cast a vote, and the caucuses, where you run around a room and stand behind a representative of the candidate you want to vote for? What should we be watching this year?
So much of this, I think, from the voter's perspective, is about going into a voting booth or going into a caucus site and casting their lot with a particular candidate. But we often lose sight of what the real metric of winning this nomination is going to be. And that's true on the Republican side as well. But that's accruing delegates. As much as we can focus on the umpteen candidates that threw their hat in the ring and the winnowing we've seen to this point, it's very likely that we're going to see the field winnow down to a smaller and smaller number of candidates as we get into the voting phase of this. And a large factor in that is going to be that 15% threshold that we mentioned earlier. It's really a high bar, and it's going to determine who qualifies for delegates and who is able to legitimately move on and say, I'm actually viable for this nomination. Sure, candidate X remains in the race, is still continuing to get votes, but they're not qualifying for delegates. That's the lifeblood of any nomination campaign.
That's really what counts. And do you see a year when there might not be anyone who comes out with enough to declare themselves the candidate? We know that the delegates then go to the convention and they cast their votes there, but do you see a contested convention?
I think my line for the last 4 years has been, if we were going to see a contested convention, it would have been 4 years ago on the Republican side. It remains to be seen whether we'll see any similar sort of chaos on the Democratic side in 2020. There are some earmarks that it may be in the offing, right? I think we mentioned Super Tuesday before. It's a date where a third of the delegates, pledged delegates, are going to be at stake on that day. So if you've got three or four candidates coming in to Super Tuesday with some delegates and get through Super Tuesday with even more delegates and splits them in such a way that it's going to prevent one candidate from getting to a majority. So a lot of that's California joining with Texas and some other states on Super Tuesday to make that happen. And that also kind of overlaps with the Democratic Party's proportional method of allocation. Mm-hmm. That if you win 20%, for instance, you're going to get about 20% of the delegates out of that state.
One last question. Kansas and Alaska are having a firehouse caucus. Remind us what that is.
So a firehouse caucus, again, this is kind of a response to some of the changes to the Democratic Party's rules for 2020. We can make a distinction between caucuses on the one hand that are run by state parties and state-run, state government-run primaries. Mm-hmm. What Kansas and Alaska are trying to do is kind of thread the needle between those two and have a state party-run primary. Most of the voting places are firehouses. It operates pretty much like a primary would, the only difference being the state parties paying for it and implementing it.
And not the state government.
Not the state government. And, I mean, there's some funding issues that go along with that that makes it harder for parties to pull that off.
Yeah. Josh Putnam, founder of the election tracking website Frontloading HQ. He also writes about the primary process for political sites like the Rasmussen Reports and the Washington Post. And Josh, one last thing. It's an incredibly divisive year. This should be fun, right? Voting in a primary or a caucus?
It should be. I suspect we're going to see some decent turnout numbers when we get into this thing starting in Iowa 12 days from now.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Remember, voting is fun. It's a privilege.
China is taking unprecedented steps to try to contain a deadly new virus that has sickened hundreds and is spreading during the busy Lunar New Year travel season. Cities are being locked down, including Wuhan, where the virus started. Joining us now is NPR's Emily Feng. She's in Beijing. Emily, these cities that we're talking about are home each to millions of people. How does the government lock them down?
They do it transport line by transport line. First, they start, as they did in Wuhan, with the airports and the train stations. In Wuhan, they locked everything down by 10 a.m. this morning. And people who were live streaming this quarantine being carried out showed soldiers literally marching up to the train station with masks on, barricading the doors and preventing people from entering the station and leaving. That then meant people tried to leave by car because the highways were open for a while. Those highways are now being sealed, so slowly you know, bit by bit, people have been sealing off the entry points and exit points to these cities.
Well, and I've seen some reporting that people are maybe okay with the fact that they're being kept where they live, but they're not so satisfied with the amount of care that is available to them if they're feeling sick. Are people satisfied with how the Chinese officials are reacting to this?
It's hard to say because the information coming out of these cities has been difficult. A lot of this stuff goes on social media and then is very, very quickly deleted. One thing that I did see yesterday was that there were hundreds of people posting on social media complaining that they felt like they had fevers, that they might have the coronavirus, and they wanted to be screened at hospitals and clinics. But Wuhan hospitals have been completely stretched thin. They've been asking for doctors from cities like Beijing and Shanghai. It's still not enough, and people had been turned away as late as yesterday night. Wuhan has resolved to take as many people as they can. They've added about 5,400 hospital beds, indicating actually that authorities think this outbreak is going to get way worse before it gets better. Right now, there are about 600 confirmed cases. But right now, there's a real labor scarcity of medical talent who can deal with the number of suspected cases.
Well, when you say 600 confirmed cases, do people trust the information they're getting from officials about the number of cases, the number of deaths, et cetera, from this coronavirus?
Not at all. And they have some precedent, the most infamous of those being the 2003 SARS epidemic, which the Beijing government initially denied was happening. Eventually, they admitted that they had an epidemic on their hands, but 8,000 people were sickened, 800 people died. Just last year, there was an epidemic of swine flu affecting not humans, but pigs. But because the government didn't admit how bad the problem was, about 40% of China's pigs died before they could address the issue. So people are understandably skeptical. But the government has also been pretty open about committing to confirming the cases as they come in this week. Mm-hmm. At the same time, there's been a huge jump in the number of confirmed cases. Last week, it was around 60. This week, all of a sudden, it's reached more than 600. And so people have been suspicious. They think that perhaps these cases existed all along, and it's only until now that the government's disclosing that. Of course, we have nothing to back that allegation up, but it is a widely held suspicion.
Well, and is there any way to judge whether the measures that the government has taken so far have had any effect?
It's still too early to tell. One thing that people have been very concerned about is this virus is now national. In fact, it's international. It's in Hong Kong, it's in Japan, it's in the U.S. Simply by quarantining cities in one province in China might be too little too late because the virus is already in major cities around the world.
That is NPR's Emily Feng in Beijing. Emily, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
It's Here and Now. A movie opening tomorrow tells the story of a long fight to right an old wrong. In April 1966, members of the Army's Charlie Company were tasked with searching out a powerful Viet Cong battalion in Vietnam's dense jungle. Drastically outnumbered, they were soon ambushed by the enemy, trapped. One of the bloodiest battles of the Vietnam War, Abilene. The Viet Cong were at their side, dropping from trees. But then, also descending through those trees, a U.S. Air Force power rescuer named William Pitts Pitzenbarger. In the helicopter above, he'd made the decision to join the fighters.
Somebody needs to go down there and get them straightened out. No way, it's hot as hell down there, Pitts. Those people can't wait, they've lost the medic.
Ken Alderson was second in command of Charlie Company. He told us what he thought when he saw Pitts descending through that thick canopy.
I said, this guy does not know what he's getting into. But once your boots meet the ground, it's a different environment.
Pitts soon became one of them, a mud soldier, sending the wounded back up to the helicopter, waving it off when his fellow airmen wanted him to come as well. He'd saved nearly 60 lives before losing his own. Members of Charlie Company, as well as Pitzenbarger's Air Force comrades, spent years trying to get him a posthumous Medal of Honor. It rarely goes to airmen, and in this case, the Pentagon may not have wanted a reminder of that disastrously planned day. But Pitt's friends finally succeeded after 32 years. Writer-director Todd Robinson tells their story in The Last Full Measure. He joins us from WYSO in Yellow Springs, Ohio. Todd, welcome.
Hi, Robin.
And I'm going to disclose right here, one of the reasons I've been following the making of this film is that you hired my brother to be in it, actor John Savage, and thank you for that because it's such a sweet film. But also it's a reminder, he played Steve in The Deer Hunter, and this film does feel as if it's, you know, the characters from that iconic Vietnam War film now in their early 70s.
It does sort of close the loop on that character from The Deer Hunter, for sure.
Yeah, and so we'll talk more about the film. But also with us is Fred Navarro, one of the veterans that Todd Robinson interviewed for the film and also made that fight for Pitts getting the Medal of Honor posthumously. Fred, what did Pitts mean to you? Did you see him on the ground?
Yes, during the lull in the fighting, I heard this whining sound, and then I saw Pitzenbauer coming down through the trees in a litter. It was like seeing the angel come down through the jungle to save us, and that's what Pitzenbauer would end up doing.
Yeah. It's just so hard to convey how awful this time was. You guys are surrounded. You've been boxed in, maybe set up. Can you describe how frightening and what a carnage it was?
It was total chaos. Can you imagine 700 guns firing at the same time? And some of us could see the enemy. Most of us could not. It was crazy. But Pitzenbauer was crawling and running, trying to take care of the wounded. He would hear the wounded hollering for help, and he would run to them and take care of them.
With bullets whizzing by him.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, you've said you became friends. This went on for hours. Enough time to really, you know, bond with this person and also be in awe of him. I mean, did you see him wave away the helicopters?
Yes. The pilot waved Pitzenbauer to get on the litter and let's get out of here. But Pitzenbauer came there to save lives, and that's what he was doing. The PJ model is these things we do so others may live. He waved the pilot off. And to this day, the pilot doesn't know if Pitzenbauer had got in the litter with the two wounded soldiers, if he had been able to lift off or not.
Todd, Fred mentions PJs. Isn't that how you got involved in this before you even knew Pitt's story? You found out about what these people did.
Yeah, they're called pararescue jumpers or pararescue medics, and they're highly trained combat medics, and they're there to evacuate the wounded, tend to their wounds, and as Fred said, these guys will trade their lives for yours. The culture is just replete with stories like this. And it was just irresistible as the subject of a film.
And when you were researching the PJs, you ended up at a base where Pitts's father was speaking. And he said something. I mean, this is a man who'd been mourning the death of his son in Vietnam. And then the fact that he didn't get this medal that so many felt he deserved. And his father said something that also gripped your heart.
He lamented that he had never gotten to see his son fall in love, have a child of his own, because only then could he understand how much his father loved him. And that just knocked me out. I had a 7-year-old son, a 3-year-old daughter at the time, and trying to wrap my head around what it would be like to lose one of them. And then I flash back even further to my own dinner table where we often watched in the early 1970s the Vietnam War play out on television. And I realized that my father was deeply concerned that I would soon be of draftable age and that he could lose me to something as existentially impossible to deal with as a draft lottery number.
Yeah.
And so when those ideas sort of all came together, it became clear to me that there was a story to tell, and it was the story about not only the combat and the long path to get Pitzenbauer the medal, but it was also about the families that support our fighting men and women.
Yeah. And Fred, it's about what happens to people like you who leave people behind on the battlefield. People have been talking about how Pitts saved lives. One of the things that he did was he'd pull the dead over on top of those who were wounded because the Viet Cong kept coming through and you'd have to play dead on different occasions. But are you one of those that we see in the film has had a very hard time with the fact that you survived and people like Pitts and others didn't?
Yes, after I was wounded, the fighting got really bad, and Pitzenbauer and I became friends. He always came back to me. He would disappear and take care of the wounded, and he would come back to my location. He took his armored vest off and put it on my chest.
Oh, that's you.
Excuse me. And then he pulled the two dead Americans on top of me to protect me, and he disappeared again. Later he would come to my location again, and he would take my rifle and give me his pistol. And that's when he was killed. I wanted to get to him, but because of the weight of the soldiers and my condition, I was unable to get up from under those bodies. And then night fell, and I thought and I wondered all night if he was alive or not. Yeah. And I found out in the morning that he had died.
You know what you can't see, Robin? What you can't see that I can see is that Fred's really full of emotion. And whenever these men are interviewed and asked to talk about this, it actually is traumatic. It brings up all of these feelings over and over again. And so what you're hearing in these delays is really raw emotion.
Yeah. Well, I know you're both in Ohio for a special screening of The Last Full Measure in William Pitzenbarger's hometown of Piqua tonight. That's got to be a delayed homecoming and not the one that everybody would have wanted, decades ago. But, Fred, I'm imagining you're looking forward to seeing him celebrated tonight.
Oh, yes. There's a lot of veterans that are here today. We came together to honor William Pitzenbauer one more time. It's a sad feeling, but because I've thought about it so many times over the years, but it's a happy feeling to be able to honor William Pitzenbauer once again.
Yeah. Fred, I want to thank you especially. Thank you so much for talking, no matter how painful. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Todd, thanks to you as well.
Thank you, Robin.
Todd Robinson, creator of The Last Full Measure, the story of pararescuer William Pitzenbauer. We also spoke with one of the men Pitzenbauer saved, Fred Navarro.
The largest rollout of elections equipment in U.S. history is happening in Georgia. It's a big year for voters there. Before the presidential election in November, there will be several primaries and special elections, and the pressure is on to install more than 33,000 new voting machines in all 159 counties before the presidential primary in March. Let's talk more about this with Stephen Fowler, politics reporter for Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, Jeremy.
So why is Georgia introducing these new voting machines and equipment now?
Well, it's twofold. First, they've been trying to update the machines to something that is safer and more secure. The old voting machines that Georgia was using are almost two decades old, running an old, outdated version of Windows, and generally probably not that secure. Second, a federal judge has said they can no longer use those old machines after 2019, so the option is the new voting machines now, and if those aren't ready, using hand-marked paper ballots.
And how much more secure are the new voting machines?
Well, there's an additional component added to Georgia's voting now. It's paper. And so a touchscreen voting machine is what people will make their selections on. And instead of hitting cast ballot, they will hit print ballot. And that will print out a piece of paper that has a text summary of all of the races and the choices that a voter makes and a QR code in the top left corner. Now, a voter has to take that piece of paper and insert it into a scanner, and that's how they count their ballot. And so there's this extra step of reviewing that is more secure than using just a touchscreen only that records your vote on a memory card.
Well, and I want to get to some of the concerns about that. But first of all, the state has a very short window of time to implement all of these new machines before March. How are officials planning to do that?
Well, the Secretary of State's office in Georgia says that they have at least half of Georgia's 159 counties have received all of their machines so far. That includes all of the bigger counties where Atlanta and some of the other metro areas are. And they're constantly delivering these machines, and they have to pick up and store the old machines because of a court order. So it's a big logistical battle. And they say that all of the counties in Georgia should have all of their machines, printers, election management software, everything that they need by the middle of February, which will give the counties enough time to prepare for the March 24th presidential primary.
So what are the concerns regarding the new voting system?
Well, it's that QR code. You know, I can't read QR code. You can't read right. QR code. And so some election integrity advocates say that there's really no way to be 100% sure that the vote that you vote is accurate because of what's on that QR code may or may not line up to what is on the text on the page, which may or may not line up to what you picked on that touchscreen. So advocates are saying that Georgia needs to eliminate electronic voting, eliminate the machines, and take it straight from a voter's mind to their pen to the paper.
Well, and the other thing is, if they're implementing this, let's say, by February, and then they've got to use them in March, if there are some problems with the machines, are the poll workers going to be trained enough to deal with those problems?
You know, that's a question that some counties have had in this rollout process. The thing about these new machines that Georgia is using is that, for the most part, it's very similar to how elections have been run. We have a touchscreen that the voting is conducted on. We have, you know, a check-in process and things like that. And so there have been trainings that have been happening since this Dominion voting system was selected last fall. And so people aren't going in completely blind, but we have the March presidential primary, we have some federal primaries and elections over the summer, and then we have the presidential election in the fall. So by the time November rolls around, there will be several election cycles, so things should run smoothly by then, is the thought.
I'm glad you used the word blind, because I know that one of the concerns there is that voters who are visually impaired may not be able to see what is on the printout of their votes and check it.
Well, you know, yesterday was the state election board meeting where some of the rules governing the use of these machines were discussed, and several people from the National Federation for the Blind and other advocates said that they want to make sure that there is the opportunity to review that printed paper ballot before the ballot is cast. And so now there is a rule that has been proposed that would allow people who are visually impaired to use some sort of assistive technology to review that paper before it's scanned.
How do voters feel about the changes coming to the voting machines?
Well, you know, a lot of people that I've talked to that have used the machines in pilot elections say it was super easy and simple, and they liked having a piece of paper that they could touch. But a lot of people still don't know that there's something different. And there are still others who say that electronic voting just isn't the most safe and secure, and they're worried about the integrity of November's election.
Now, in the back of everyone's mind is the race in 2018 when Stacey Abrams, the Democrat, narrowly lost to Brian Kemp, the Republican, in the governor's race. And Abrams claimed that voter suppression by Kemp, who was Secretary of State, kept her from victory. How much does this overhaul have to do with that race?
Well, the overhaul was already planned ahead of the gubernatorial election. I think the results kind of flavored what the change was going to be. Some people pushed for hand-marked paper ballots. Georgia ended up going with a ballot-marking device. And so I think what you're going to see, this kind of groundswell of electoral angst take hold into this next November's election with the new machines and with pivotal races on the ballot, that a lot of people are going to be paying attention to how voting works in Georgia.
That is Stephen Fowler, who is politics reporter for Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. Stephen, thank you.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.